Hi, and welcome to my podcast. I shouldn't say this, but my name is Katie Leeson and I'm Managing Director of Social Chain UK. And on this week's episode, I am joined by Pippa Murray, the founder of Pip and Nut, the award-winning fastest growing nut butter brand in the UK. Her journey is incredibly interesting, going from anthropology to theatre to entrepreneurship, founding a business that started as an idea while preparing for a marathon. We discuss so many interesting topics in this chat, including the outstanding growth of the brand over the years and how, in spite of COVID, 2020 has seen them become profitable for the first time ever. We also chat about Pip and Nut's recognition as a B Corp business thanks to their focus on sustainability and the importance of word of mouth and influencer marketing. Finally, Pip reveals how her entrepreneurship was something that was developed through her resilience and determination when growing up managing dyslexia. It was a really, really good chat and I can't wait to hear your feedback on this one. Pip is just amazing, incredible female leader, and I loved her take on how women, if you've got ideas in business, how you could take that into an idea and how you journeyed through being a female entrepreneur. And you really, really do not want to miss her submission. Her I shouldn't say this but at the end is one that you need to listen out for. So sit back, relax and enjoy this episode of I Shouldn't Say This But. Welcome, Pip, to I Shouldn't Say This But. Thank you so much for joining me.
Absolute pleasure. Really looking forward to chatting to you today.
I'm going to start our conversation by a few little icebreakers, some funny ones and some really silly ones, and maybe some serious ones in there. So we'll see how we get on. So the first thing I want to ask you is, what incredibly common thing have you never done before?
So I've never eaten a kebab, which I feel is something that everyone has done. And really, at some point, late night, drunk, walking through London, I should have at some point picked one of those up. So I'm weirdly proud of it because actually I think they're disgusting, but you know, I feel like it's a bit of a rite of passage.
What two songs would you play on loop in hell?
I think my first one would be Slade, I Wish It Could Be Christmas, partly because it, you know, during Christmas time, you know, in shops, and it's just going round and round and round as a song. It is just the most annoying track ever made, I think, and also just be stuck in Christmas permanently. My second one would probably be anything by U2. I find them incredibly annoying, and sorry for any U2 fans out there, but something about Bono and his big anthemic songs that I find just really gets to me. So those, anything from them basically on loop would drive me mad.
Oh my god, I'm so with you on that. I find U2 really irritating. What was the last thing you were really excited about?
So I've been learning to surf this year, and the last thing I really just like felt so excited about was the first time I got out onto the green waves, which is like the slightly bigger waves at the back, and I was standing up, and I haven't had that feeling of like pure adrenaline for a really long time, and learning something like that completely new, I'm just like totally pumped and obsessed by it at the moment.
How often do you manage to go out?
I've been trying to go down to Cornwall actually in every 6 weeks or so, just to get a bit of fresh air, a bit of headspace, but obviously lockdown, when it, you know, rears its head, a bit grounded, but yeah, as regularly as I can do.
It's very hard, isn't it? I've heard surfing, just like a lot of upper body strength.
Yeah, so I'm a bit more of a runner than I am a kind of a yoga or kind of mobility kind of, I'm actually not very good at it, but I am quite a strong swimmer. So it's surprising the amount of upper body when you're paddling to get out. It's really like such hard work. But yeah, I mean, it's repetition. There's something in it about the kind of repetitive nature of it, and just one of those slightly annoying, determined, I won't stop until I master something kind of person. So yeah, it's got under my skin as a sport.
That's amazing. I always think like, what is my hobby? I don't even know if I've got a hobby. I'm always really jealous when someone says that they've got something, and that is a cool one to have as well. And this is quite a serious one, this last one, but what's the best piece of advice you've ever been given, and who was that from?
So I don't know if this isn't probably like necessarily a really profound piece of advice, but it's something that I often go back to. But and it was one of my investors actually that said it to me, was that I think I was saying about a problem that I was having at the time and was catastrophizing a bit, and He sort of kept reminding me, you know, it's only peanut butter, it's only nut butter. And I think there's something really poignant about kind of, I guess this is in the context of running a business, just kind of reminding yourself every so often that, like, just to pull yourself out of where you're at, because sometimes you can get a bit tunnel vision and, you know, think that the world's ending, but actually in actual fact it's fine. You need to just kind of rationalize with yourself, and it can help kind of pull you out of sometimes it's being the deer in the headlights. So I just like the kind of attitude towards that, and just being a bit grounded in your approach and when you're kind of working through challenges and issues.
I really like that. I often say that to people in work. In marketing, we're not saving lives. I know problems can seem really big, but you've got to kind of put it in a bit of perspective, haven't you, at times, because otherwise it can eat you up. So I can completely see why that'd be helpful. And I'd love now to talk to you a little bit more. You talked about making peanut butter, making nut butter. So I want to learn all about your career from university to where you are now and how you started making peanut butter and nut butter.
My background and kind of what I studied at school and university was very much an art student. So loved art, studied like geography, like sciencey or business orientated when I was sort of going through A levels. And then I went on to university and studied anthropology, which you kind of try and draw any lines towards what I do now, you'd struggle. It's not exactly completely related to what I do now. But, you know, I'm interested in people. I think that's the kind of foundation of what anthropology is about. And studied in London at UCL, and I kind of jumped into the creative arts, kind of worked through a number of art centres after uni ended, and eventually ended up at the Science Museum. And I was working as a theatre producer there. And I actually, contrary to I think a lot of entrepreneurs and business owners' stories are, I actually really loved my job. It had been something I'd worked really hard to get into. You know, the arts is actually really competitive to get in, and you don't get paid a lot through it either. But, you know, for me, when I kind of thought about my career path and what kind of led me to starting up the business, I think there was definitely something in me which I loved, the independence of running my own business and the idea of that. And also I think the reason, and there were a number of threads that I think that led me into starting up Hip the Nut, but I think the first was that food has played a really integral part of my upbringing, like a lot of people. But, you know, I grew up in a big family, always had the kind of big dinner table meals. At 13, my mum decided to give up cooking and said, right, you guys are going to do it. So right at the time when Jamie Oliver was like big on TV, that's when my mum said, you've got to cook for your sisters and me and your dad. And so from really quite early age, I was in the kitchen cooking quite elaborate meals, which made my mum's food bills go through the roof, mainly from Jamie Oliver's cookbooks. And yeah, I think being in London, you know, that particular moment when I was starting out the business, it was like the heart of like food trucks and, you know, independent brands like becoming more kind of relevant and prevalent in and around shops, but also in markets. And I just found that scene like really exciting. And I guess coupled with that was that at the time I was doing lots of running, and it's, you know, I've done quite a lot of long distance sort of marathons and things like that, and training for the Paris Marathon about the time that I sort of started to have the seed of the idea for Hip the Nut. And I remember shopping, I was eating loads of peanut butter because it's good for protein, good for running. And I remember just thinking every single product that I was looking at in the supermarket either contained palm oil or sugar, and all the brands were tired and either worthy or just really American. I was like, you know what, this is such a great product, yet it's so not being done justice. And yeah, that's where it sort of started, really. I bought a blender and tinkered around in my kitchen for a bit, and yeah, that was sort of where it came from, I guess.
So do you think when you were younger, did you think you always saw yourself as an entrepreneur, or was it because of the fact that you saw an opportunity and the fact that you liked working for yourself?
Business wasn't really something that I knew a whole lot about. So my dad's a doctor, my mum's a nurse, so very much kind of social sector, public sector. And so I didn't really, I don't think, properly understand what it was. But I think the kind of determined independent streak comes about through a number of ways, but I think one of it is sort of linked to, I'm dyslexic, and I definitely think that kind of creates a kind of attitude and resilience and determination, particularly when you're always like bottom of the class despite trying really, really hard all the time at like your spelling tests and whatever. And I think that sort of that personality trait, alongside I think being interested in a sector and sort of thinking, how do I infiltrate this, So I know I never really thought or considered business was even something that I would consider. And sometimes I even look back now thinking, how did I get here? This is so such a tangent. It's not really, you know, in my family to be kind of an entrepreneur, if you like.
What is the favorite thing about your job?
Really good question. Two things, probably, if I'm allowed to. The first would be the fact that sometimes I do catch myself and be like, when we're doing product development, we developed a load of nut butter cups, which launched last year, kind of a healthy take on Reese's, if you like. And I remember one day we spent the day trying all different types of chocolate, and they were all laid out on the table, everything from like a dairy milk right the way through to kind of like super premium, like Willy's chocolate and stuff. And I'm just sitting there being like, this is amazing that I do this as a day job and can justify this as work, if you like. So the product development stuff I love. It's great thinking through like flavor profiles and textures and how to get the best out of a product. And I think the second piece is it's got to be your team. Like, it's the thing that I don't think you think, well, I certainly didn't think about when I was starting up. I just thought about the product and the brand. But now the business has grown and we've got just a brilliant group of people that I think, oh, I'm so proud of them, and they make the job really rewarding because they're smart, I learn from them, but then also you see them grow, and I think that's really satisfying.
How have you built your team?
I mean, we're 20 now in our business, so, you know, for me it feels significant. You know, I guess it's all contextual for I know that social chain is absolutely huge, but 20 people, and that's kind of grown quite steadily over the last sort of 5 years. I think for me the key thing that I found in hiring is that it really is about attitude, and I know that gets banded around a lot, but there is something to say about really testing someone when you're trying to like interview and sense check whether or not they're interested in the brand. It's like, have they really got the attitude, like the hunger for it? It doesn't really matter if they don't necessarily know what they're doing, but if they haven't got that hunger, I think that really, like, for a startup, for a growing you know, fast growing business, if you need that when you're hiring. So definitely think attitude over experience every time. That's not to say that at some point you do need to get experience in the company, but certainly in the early days you need kind of broad people who are willing to kind of flex across a number of different areas, roll up their sleeves, and then you kind of introduce people with slightly more experience. But that attitude piece never leaves. I think that's the thing that I spend most of my time trying to tease out of people when I'm in an interview, which I often find is the worst time to try and find out really how someone is in an interview setting. But yeah, so that would probably be my kind of main thing when I think about building a team.
That is exactly what we look for when we hire as well. I would forgo the most experienced person's CV if their attitude and they didn't, I say culture fit, but I don't mean in terms of the type of person or how they look or fitting them in a box, but it is attitude. And I think it's so important, because one person that you bring in could be really experienced, but they could have such an impact on the rest of your team. And it's something that it's so hard to keep going, isn't it, as you grow. And as you add more people on, you're always a little bit nervous that you might lose that if you bring that one bad hire in, could really impact everybody. So yeah, I'm in complete agreement with you there. So those are your favorite parts, but like anything, we've got to have a least favorite part. What's your least favorite part?
Legal contracts. Oh my god, the amount of stuff that I now look at that's like legal related is more than it's ever been before. I think that's HR related stuff as much as it is manufacturing contracts to investment rounds and things like that. I have very little patience. I've got a really short attention span when it comes to that kind of detail, so I have to really like force myself to like take up every distraction off my desk, off my emails, and just kind of like focus on reading through something, because I, you know, they're super important, they're there for a reason, and they can really catch you out if you do quite look at them properly. But yeah, it's my bugbear. But yeah, it's just, you just have to do it, don't you? They can't all be tasting chocolate every day.
It's that pressure as well of knowing that if you get it wrong, it could really cause problems. I think that adds to it, because it makes you feel like, I've really got to concentrate on this now. Tell me about Pip and Nut's growth over the years. How have you got to where you've got to today?
I guess when the brand launched, it was our first customer was Selfridges, so an amazing customer to have, and still to this day, it's like one of my proudest achievements is like landing that particular customer. And it was such a catalyst for what was then to come. And I think, like, when you're building a product into retail or in any kind of context, I guess, is that you really have to kind of start with your halo accounts, your kind of goals, I guess, for if you're a client-based business like yours, it would be like you'd really be nurturing those kind of like key clients. And that's for us is just like you build your case studies in those key stores and then you start to leapfrog into slightly bigger stores. So it started with Selfridges and we grew throughout London initially because that's where we were based. And then we hop-footed into Ocado, then it was Sainsbury's, then it was, Tesco, then it was Asda, then it was Morrison's, and then lots of other customers around the outside as well. But we're in about, I'd say we're about over 7,000 stores now in the UK and Ireland. And I think it has to be said, I mean, it takes time. And I think that it's been an amazing trajectory and like in terms of where I saw the business going when I started out. I genuinely don't think I could have anticipated the kind of the path that we've taken. So we've been incredibly fortunate for that. But I think the key thing is to make sure, particularly when you're selling into retail, where you're suddenly going from one store to then 600 in Sainsbury's, as an example, is all do it in bites that you can actually afford to support. And I think it's key, like very easy to get greedy and say, yeah, I want 1,000 Tesco stores. And you go in and then you realize your rate of sale is rubbish because it's really difficult to sell in some of the harder stores that are in slightly more kind of areas that maybe your audience aren't. And so actually it's sometimes better to start with less and build up. And I think that's probably been one of our successes, is that over time we've learned the lesson that you've got to kind of build sustainably. And if you can sell more through probably 5 stores than you can sometimes through 100 if you just focus your energies. But I think the real things and reason why I think we've been so successful, brand I think plays a huge part to play. And I think we have got such a personality driven brand. It's super distinctive in our category, but also wider food and drink. And I think with that, that's allowed us to have such a like fun, I guess, as a marketing team, being able to kind of really build the brand outside of the product and the world that you see, in terms of whether it's events that we're doing at Taste of London to the stuff that we launched through social and most recently some of our above the line activity. Like, it's the distinctiveness that's allowed us to protect, I think, the brand and what we've been able to do. And then I think second to that, but not really second, is number one is that the product has to be really good. And I think sometimes when you're growing really quickly, you can forget about how important it is that you make sure what's inside your product or your actual, for us, our nut butter is just the best in the market. And the smallest things make such a big difference. And I think never losing sight of that, I think, is never rush a product. I've rushed products out the door and they've not worked. And it's the biggest failing. You'll never get a repeat purchase if it doesn't taste nice. And it's a really basic point, but never should be forgotten, because you're selling a product. It's got to completely smash it out of the park when someone tries it. So I think that for me is probably two pillars, is like product and brand. It's the basics, get it right, and hopefully the rest will follow.
How did you come up with that brand? Where did it originate from? You said it's got a really distinct personality in comparison to the market.
I mean, the name came from me in terms of just a random brainstorm in my own head. And it actually initially, when I was sort of working with an agency to kind of build out the identity, we pushed it aside for a while and we're like, you know what, we need something a bit more sort of distinctive, or perhaps it wasn't right. But actually when it kind of came to life in the identity that you see today, it just was so brilliant. But I think for me, there are a few things, you know, when you're looking, particularly again in retail, you've got to like look at where you're selling. And, you know, back then, 7-8 years ago, the category that we sell into is peanut butter, obviously, and everything was brown, everything was beige, monkey nuts and gorillas everywhere. It was just awful, like really poor. And actually one of the things that we decided to do was create real kind of distinctiveness through just owning white as a color. And if you kind of look at us in store, you'll see that we're like this white band through like a sea of brown, and it really helps us grab people. So it's things like that where you can think, how can you follow category cues, so like kind of follow kind of what things will people will be expecting when they kind of are shopping for a product like this, but then also be distinctive and disruptive. And it's a fine balance, I think. But the identity itself was working with an absolutely brilliant agency who just really understood what it was and the feeling that I was trying to communicate. And I think that's the key, is like finding an agency that when you go in that room and you're talking fluidly about your brand and what your vision for it is, that you feel that they understand you, and that you have a gut feeling about them. And I think that's a really intangible thing that you can't really measure. It's, and you know, your creative agency is one of the most important agent kind of relationships that you'll foster in those early days when you're creating your identity, your brand, and all the packaging that wraps around it.
Well, they're bringing your baby to life, aren't they? That's what they're doing in those early stages as well. They're taking something that you've been cultivating and you've got plans for and you've got dreams for, and they're making it into something that's taking it out into the big wide world. So I guess you've really got to get that relationship right and feel like you can trust the team to do the right thing for the brand and for you.
Trust is such a big part of it. You've got to trust that they know how to do this, and you've got to relinquish a bit of control, because obviously they've got to be the creators, and you've got to let, I think, creatives create. And if you're too restrictive in all the parameters that you give to them, then you get something that's just really not right, and it will frustrate both sides of you know, the creative agency and yourself. So there's an element of like, let people breathe whilst giving them direction and to some extent.
2020 has been a year. Has COVID changed the brand at all?
This pandemic has completely shifted consumers' behaviours. They're shopping online more, and they're buying more for their homes and eating more at home. I think there's something like 500 million more meals eaten at home when people are in lockdown than there would be if you were kind of out and about around the UK, which is mad. So with that, we're a product that's predominantly, our nut butters are eaten at home for breakfast. They're also really tasty, quite comforting, but also quite healthy. So that's that nice balance that I think people are looking for. And they're sold through a lot of the retailers that people are shopping in that are still open, fortunately. So the grocery stores, and then also online, so Amazon, Ocado. And, you know, it's those channels that for us have just exploded. And, you know, through the panic buying in March, April, like, we saw sales in some of those retailers just go through the roof, and online in particular. We have our own direct consumer website as well, and that sort of, that points were up by 1,000%. So responding to some of that demand has and is a challenge, because we're kind of back in it again. So yeah, it's a great thing. And the brilliant thing about it is that, you know, you're finding that people that maybe might not have picked up the brand before are suddenly trying it. So we've recruited loads more shoppers into the business. So yeah, it certainly accelerated us as a business forwards. And for us as a business, we've also now become profitable, which as a result of the growth that we've seen this year, which is a great feeling, I think, as a business, to be able to kind of sustain ourselves and kind of be on a really good footing going into next year. But then I think as a brand, I think it's accelerated a little bit more about, I mean, we certified as a B Corp last year, and actually a lot, I think, over the last 9 months, you know, Black Lives Matter, COVID obviously being a huge social challenge, both in terms of like food poverty throughout the UK, you know, redundancies, things like that. And I think as a business, we've responded quite a lot to a few of those issues and been more vocal than we've ever been before about things that we're seeing in our world that either we naturally impact or actually have an opinion on. And that's sort of one thing which I think we've kind of shifted, I guess, as a business, become a little bit more socially engaged and responsible, I think. So for instance, we've just launched launched a range that sort of a charitable donation to our local food bank in Hackney. So for our latest limited edition, we launched a gingerbread almond butter, and every pack sold will donate 25p to Hackney Food Bank. And we've also been doing a kind of donate one, you give one, we'll give one campaign, where we donate sort of peanut butter to their local food bank, which is sort of essential product within what they give out to people who are vulnerable. So it's things like that which I think it's totally shifted my mindset, I think, about your role as a business in the context of society, and that you have a platform. And it's one of the things which, if I look at 2020, I feel really sort of proud that we started to actually make proper steps towards being a brand that's not just selling peanut butter. It has a view of other things as well.
Just to touch again on the increase, you said at points you're up 1,000% on your online sales. Have you struggled with supply chains to get that amount of product out? And if you have, how have you managed to handle that?
Yeah, I mean, we operate across three manufacturing sites. There's one in Europe, which has got its own challenges, I guess, because they've had different delays in terms of their what's been going on in sort of one of our factories is based in the Netherlands. So they've been going in and out of lockdown at different points to us. And then we've got two in the UK. The thing that we've had to shift, I think, quite dramatically is, I guess, the way that, and this is perhaps a bit boring, but the way that we forecast, we used to just kind of do every week we're checking in on the forecast. Now we're doing it daily. Because if you can get your forecast right and give the right forecast to your manufacturers, then you're more likely to be able to actually get the product out of their doors. I think the other thing that we've had to do is like sit on a lot more stock than we would do normally because we just don't know what's happening. And so, I mean, that eats up cash that you don't necessarily want to be sitting and stockpiling. But at the same time, you kind of need to make sure like the number one thing is that you don't want empty shelves. But I think it generally just puts a lot of pressure on your team. And I think the ops team in particular, I think, you know, they've had quite a sustained level of kind of pressure on them to deliver and perform whilst also working with manufacturers who are also really under pressure from every brand. And I think this then comes down to like, how good are your relationships with the people that you work with, i.e. the partners that you work with? So, and having good manufacturing relationships just means that you can ask for those favors. And that's, I think, a big learning for us is like, you know, you've got to celebrate the good times, but weather the bad with any kind of partner that you're working with. And I think that's all dependent on how well you are in the bad times and how well you treat each other and the kind of how you communicate with people is super important.
I'd be interested to know as well, because you touched on the brand change and becoming a bit more of a brand that stands for something. Have you seen a change from lockdown 1.0 to lockdown 2.0 where people are more considerate of others this lockdown than they were in the first one? I'm asking that question because I know how my mindset has changed throughout the two lockdowns, and this time I'm very much more aware of the impact of what lockdown has on people than I think the first time around was just pretty much trying to focus on getting through. I don't know when you launched your donation back to the food banks and if you can see a difference in people's mindset.
I think businesses that are thriving, I think in this context, there are lots obviously that are doing brilliantly and some that aren't. I think there is, you know, people are much more, consumers are much more conscious of like businesses giving back. I think I also do think that people are much more conscious of things like independent brands and shopping independently by the nature of, I guess, how long and persistent this, I guess, COVID has been going and how that's impacting certain businesses and small businesses in particular. Mental health feels like a way bigger topic now. And I think it's maybe impacting also how people are shopping as well. So this isn't so necessarily socially responsible shopping, but certainly I think shopping is slightly more for comfort and slightly more those that obviously can afford it. I know there are also lots of people in really difficult situations when it comes to redundancies and furlough. But yeah, I think there's a lot more people shopping for like things that make them feel good, that support that kind of need to kind of protect oneself, if you like. But mental health, I think, is the biggest. And I think it's within the workplace, it's probably the topic that we talk about probably the most. And that's a big shift, I think, from the first lockdown where it was like quite adrenaline fueled, quite, and we're not exhilarating because it was obviously a pandemic, but like, you know, you're responding to immediate challenges. So there's sort of a bit of a fight or flight moment, whereas now it's sort of the repetition is in and setting in. And I think that mental health sort of, oh my God, this is happening again, like feeling is upon us.
I completely can agree with that and see that. We ran into the pandemic like a bull in a china shop and we just didn't stop for all those months. We just went at it. We saw it as an opportunity. It sounds horrible, but in a way that we knew that we had to in order to just continue the great work that we could do in light of clients stopping spending and the Facebook ad boycott. There was quite a lot that happened, so we had to throw ourselves into it and find the opportunities within it. But this time around, I can completely, the way you've just put that, it's been something that's been niggling on the back of my mind, and I know a lot of our team, they're just tired. I think everyone's just tired now, and it's getting so close to Christmas, you can kind of see a break in sight. So yeah, it's interesting the way you've just put it, the differences between the two and the impact that it's had on company and the team's workload and the way that they respond to it, that's massively helpful for me, because it's the company culture whilst we're in lockdown is something that is really it's a challenge right now, isn't it, of trying to keep a company culture. I'd love to know about your company culture, and also if there's any tips to share of how you've managed to sustain that throughout lockdown.
We have got a really lovely company culture. So I think we were already building on what was quite a good foundation. So thankfully, I think going into something like this where it really shakes it up is that, you know, we've got a strong base. But having said that, we're, you know, really sociable, quite a young team. We work in sort of East London, so it's always going out all the time. We kind of rely on this really like organic, natural, like Thursday night drinks and all the stuff that you do that just mean that you like the people that you work with, essentially. Now feels like you have to be much more kind of mindful of exactly how you're going to try and get pull the team together, because you're just all in separate, obviously, houses, and you can't be so organic about it. So it's probably my, like, on my to-do list most days will be like, that will be something that I'll be focusing on most days, is like, what am I doing to make sure that people are feeling good and inspired, is mainly the thing that I get most concerned about, is that real lack of inputs and creativity then start, is like kind of hampered. So some of the things that we've done, and I think shifted, I guess, from the first to the second lockdown, is like, actually, rather than just always like trying to make every day like do really fun things, which sometimes things like a pub drinks, virtual pub drinks, actually, it's not that fun when you've been on Zoom every day, is actually like trying to think of things that are actually going to help people or bring people together in a slightly more just slightly more constructive way. So things like bringing in inspiring speakers into the business has been really great. So every 2 weeks I'm trying to think of like people that I've met along my journey that I can come in and get to talk to the team and they can hear from. We had Trini Woodall come into the Zoom yesterday, actually. She's started up a brand called Trini London, amazing D2C beauty brand that's flying. And yeah, she sort of spoke about her journey, and you could genuinely see the team lift and that feeling of like, oh yeah, we're in a dynamic company as well, and you get ideas and it sparks off like things that you could do differently. So I think trying to inspire and really break up the monotony is like my number one challenge at the moment. So we've also done things like peer-to-peer learning. So I've been like setting the team, like different members of the team, like we're doing one on digital marketing in a couple of weeks. We just did one on kind of PowerPoint, just like getting the team together to kind of talk and learn and just like be together in a relatively structured way, but also allows for kind of more free-flowing conversations too. So those are probably during lockdown what I think's worked well. And I think outside of lockdown is like trying to get people, if they feel comfortable, back into the office, because I really don't think you can beat those sort of face-to-face interactions. Just, you know, if you work with great, lovely people that you like, yeah, you really miss that, I think.
Definitely, it's the thing that I miss the most about, because I've been in the office once or twice a week since we were allowed out of proper full lockdown, and there's very few people in there, which I get, and I understand people need to feel comfortable about being in the space and being on public transport, and that's my utmost concern, is that people's safety. But it is something that the sooner I can get people back in the office, the better, because you just do your to-do list, don't you? You live off your calendar. Those short little conversations, just like that could spark an idea or build better relationships with people, is really, really tough to do. So yeah, I know, I'm with you. Something that's the thing that does keep me awake at night, because the social chain culture is famous. It's known for being something so special. And it's that challenge of making sure that we continue to lead the way while we're all working in such weird times.
The people that are in your business are also working in your company because that's one of the reasons which they really wanted to, like, because it has that great culture, that it's fun and like you do silly things and, you know, it's sociable. So when you, I think it's, if you're working, I don't know, I don't want to typecast accountants, but if you're in an accountancy firm, you probably don't expect that of your work. It's not part of your day to day, and you're okay just doing 9 to 5 and that being okay, and you switch off and all's good. But you know, you work really hard when you're working in a fast growing company. It's really tough. And so, but with the reward comes is like that lovely group of people that you hang out with, that you do those spontaneous kind of stuff with. So yeah, I think it's really different, I think, when you work in businesses like ours, the context is totally different.
I want to touch on sustainability, though, on the brand and how important sustainability is. And also, just throw in a little bit of a curveball there. Do you think that the government announcement about high sugar, salt, fat content advertisement bans on digital, how do you think that that's going to impact the brand?
Yeah, really good. Yeah, the high fat, sugar, salt is something we've been watching because we were kind of waiting ever since Boris made his announcements about it. I think it's a really great move in the right direction for like fundamentally obesity. Like, you know, it's a key thing that keeps people's, if you kind of control kind of the amount of advertising spend that's going out for those sorts of products, then that's brilliant. It does. I mean, for us, we're not a high HFSS brand. Our products don't fall within that, except probably our nut butter cups, which are kind of chocolate and confectionery. So for that, it means that we'll have to kind of really shift perhaps the way that we think with that particular product. But our nut butters aren't, so it does leave the kind of opportunity to kind of, I guess, share and build our the awareness of our products through advertising still and through social. But I think from a sustainability perspective, it's high on our agenda. Like I said, we're a B Corp, and B Corps are the businesses that balance people, planet, and profit, and they should be on equal footing. So it's the triple bottom line, and decisions should be made in considering all of those elements. So, you know, we're a product-based business, so naturally we have an impact on the planet, and everything we do, like, you know, we want to try and leave things better than we found it. But, you know, fundamentally we do create waste and manufacture things. So, you know, that is for me a big priority over the next sort of 5 years about how we can really change some of those outputs. So for starters, I mean, we certify as a B Corp, so naturally that's sort of part of our DNA in terms of how we think. But the plans that we're putting in place at the moment in particular are kind of working towards goals like becoming carbon neutral and potentially net zero by 2025. So it's a bigger task that we're first starting out with doing a full carbon footprinting of our business to understand what our impact is. And then from there, we can start to build a plan as to how we kind of reach some of those goals. And I think it's good to set yourself those big, scary goals, particularly that one where, you know, we're a manufacturing product. So it's not going to be easy to change our supply chain for the better, but we have to do it. So, yeah, I think in today's day and age, if you're not thinking about it, you're going to be left behind in about 3 or 4 years. And it has to be an integral part of what you do. So to answer your question, yes, sustainability is big on our agenda. But it takes time. And I think that's the thing to kind of be mindful of, is that when you're trying to change infrastructure, there comes cost associated with it. We're moving all our products into glass next year. And it's costing us about £500,000 pounds to do it. So it's not cheap. So you have to kind of build a plan that does it over time and that is like reasonable for the team that you've got in terms of workload, whilst also balancing, obviously, still growing as a business and supporting other the brand.
Great, it's lovely to hear. But it's managing that balancing act for you, but it's really tough as well. How do your investors? Because you've got investors, haven't you? How do your investors feel when you're doing that? Because obviously, investors invest to make money.
We did a venture capital round last year, but actually, we were almost certified by that point as a B Corp, so they had to sign on to our sort of company articles of association with that embedded within it, that decisions will be made based upon people, planet, profit. So if they didn't like it, then ultimately the investment wouldn't have happened. So I think there's an element of buy-in, but so we've been lucky that they haven't thrown their toys out the pram. But I'd also say that, again, like a bit like what I was saying about the good, you know, it's what happens in the bad times. So what if we were having a really bad year in terms of profit or revenue, and then what would be the decisions would be? And I think that we haven't experienced that yet, but I think that'll be an interesting test to understand, well, are we really going to put our money where our mouth is? Because it's easier to do it when you're in the good times to invest in some of these long-term plans versus short-term wins.
Yeah, I completely see that. Like, it's really hard to get out of the trenches if it's a challenging time, to really focus on forward thinking and making sure your brand is future proofed. You mentioned social media briefly before. How important is it for Pip & Nut?
It's so important. We've got a pretty substantial social following. So we've got about 150,000 across our social feeds, which has predominantly been growing organically over the last 5 years, and actually mostly only this year really have we started to actually do performance marketing and invest on kind of social ads and things like that. So we've got a brand that really resonates with people online. Like, one of the reasons why it's organically grown is because we've got so much word of mouth. You know, every day we'll have hundreds of people tagging us in their breakfast, in their smoothies, their kind of shakes, whatever it is that they're making. So naturally that word of mouth has really enabled us to kind of drive our following forwards, and the engagement tends to be really high. And so one of the things about Nutbusted, I think, was just one of those like lucky things that it's a product that people get really addicted to it and really emphatic. So you get the most amazing comments that come through our social, like, oh my god, this stuff is like crack, and like just people going like so excited when we drop a new product. Like, it's so amazing to see, like, to the point where I'm like, oh my god, I'm not even this obsessed by it and I run the business. But and you know what, it's so rewarding to be able to have that kind of like little window into perhaps a segment of our consumers and what they say about our products. We've learned stuff along the way, and I think funnily enough, sometimes when we've tried really hard to create content that we think our fans will like, it's sometimes, you know, the stuff that looks more organic, that's more naturally flowing into our feed, rather than necessarily sometimes we've been too stylized and, you know, thinking we're being a bit clever, actually that's the stuff that doesn't land so well. So we have to kind of be a bit more kind of mindful about like, what is it that people want to see from us, what gets them interested. And sometimes the really quick and dirty content that you can produce a bit on the fly can be really successful. So yeah, I think we're born in the digital age, so it's something which has been part of our kind of marketing pillars from day one.
Nice. And I think user generated content with Gen Z, everyone's a creator now, so everyone's creating for their own platform, so it's gonna only benefit you, isn't it, if they're all creating these pieces of really normal looking content that someone's created because they've bought the product. I'd love to know, do you work with influencers in the same way? I saw a brilliant piece of reactive content from you guys, actually. Matt Haig, I saw that he had put something on his Instagram and then you sent him some product. And I thought, yeah, absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, we do work with influencers, mainly in that kind of form where we'll send kind of, we just launched the Ultimate, which is like a really delicious peanut butter with like sourdough, and we sent it in a really lovely package, and we sent it out to, I think, 300 or so influencers that over time we've also been nurturing. So they're people that we've always given like first product drops to, and they tend to kind of post and do call outs, but which we've not really done yet. It's something that we're thinking about doing, but we're just kind of mindful of like, if we're going to work with somebody, some influencers that maybe have bigger reach or something that's actually paid for, they kind of have to already be organically using our products to feel authentic. So not dipped into that side of it yet, but influencers and in real life events and stuff, when they were something that we could do, was something that we do quite a lot of actually as well. Getting people together and doing fun events with influencers as well has been really key in our kind of growing our audience and keeping kind of the brand like hot and exciting.
Influencers is such an interesting space. It's also going to be something I know that you're going to need to put performance marketing behind, because organic reach now isn't as easy. So I think in the next 12 months, influencer marketing is going to be really interesting to see how it develops out. I know that you've moved, you mentioned the real world, and you've created a cookbook. What's your favorite recipe?
Oh my god, I think this is probably like the most like basic bitch recipe probably in there, but it's just so good. Like, there's a peanut butter recipe brownie recipe that has peanut butter like rippled, or it might be almond butter like rippled through it.
Of the brand's achievements in 2020, what have you been most proud of?
Definitely our partnership with Hackney Food Bank. We are just about to post actually on our social some of the stories that are coming out through Hackney Food Bank in terms of the work that they're doing and what we're supporting with the donations that people are giving us through buying the product. And I don't know, it for me is just really powerful. I think food poverty in the UK is just unbelievably tragic that it exists. And it's the first charity partnership we've ever done. And it's just really kind of, it made me feel amazing and made me realize just how big an issue this is. And we're really only touching the sides, but it's been great working with some, I volunteer with them on Monday afternoons, just helping pack some of the boxes up for the people getting the emergency packages. And yeah, it's really humbling and scary all at the same time.
Yeah, that's amazing. How do you find the time to do that?
I think that particular one, I think having a good team means that you can separate a little bit more to be able to do some of those things. But I think over this particularly the last few months, you know, doing things that actually give me a bit of energy. So I guess it's a bit selfish in that sense, because I find it really motivating. And like I said, a bit of a reality check. So even if my diary is like really compressed, I still want to give a bit more time. It's only 2.5 hours on a Monday, so it's not loads. But I just think it's really important for so that when I'm doing legal contracts or the boring stuff that I don't necessarily love, it just gives me the energy I need to be able to like give back to my team, I think, as well.
My diary is just absolutely bonkers. It's like back to back. And I think my best piece of advice that I think I've ever had is like create rules. And I think I've fallen off the horse with that in lockdown, because I've tried to be everything to everyone and I've not lived by creating those rules and made space for things like that. And that's something that I definitely should.
Sometimes I dabble with, would it have been better to start it up with a co-founder? And I guess I'll never really know, because sometimes what I love about running the business as a sole founder is that there's clarity of thought, you can just go for it. It's, you know, you don't have to debate anything. Obviously you want to have your team by your side, but you know, when a decision's made, it's made. Whereas when there's two or three of you or four, you know, it can cloud the waters a bit. But then I also think like sometimes during the hard moments when there are lots, that it would have been nice to have someone to like lean on who really understood. And I think that's the thing. It's when things are difficult, it can be quite tough. And also when things are amazing, you don't necessarily have, you know, that one person you can look at and be like, oh my god. I mean, obviously your team again, but it's something different when it's someone there with you. So that's maybe one thing, but apart from that, there really isn't much I would change in starting it, or what the way that we've grown. I think weirdly, even when things have gone horrifically wrong, and there have been some shockers, you kind of come out the back of it maybe a bit disheveled, but kind of learning, and kind of sometimes they become funny stories afterwards, so you kind of have to do it anyway. You have to have some of those moments.
What does the future hold for Pip and Nut?
Oh, so many good things. So I mean, for me, I guess the vision for the brand, I guess, you know, I want to become the number one natural nut butter brand in the UK and beyond. One of the things that I think's amazing about building a business and like growth, I guess, is that the bigger your business can become, like the more you can do that's good off the back of it. So, and it's also one of the reasons why I love being a B Corp, is the fact that, you know, the bigger we become, the more we can deliver on sort of our social purpose and things that we care about, things like I said, food poverty alleviation in the UK. So, you know, that for me is a goal, I guess, commercially. But then I guess I hope that, you know, we can be a real flagship brand for B Corp and really demonstrate that business can, you can be a force for good in business. It's not just about making profit. You can deliver social good through the work that you do. So that for me is an ambitious, ambitious goal, but one that has an underpinning around kind of what we can do as a kind of business in community.
Really nice. I'm going to move away from the brand now to talk a little bit more about you. As a female founder, do you ever feel like you've been disadvantaged at all?
Yeah, I think this one's an interesting question, because sometimes you don't know what you don't know. Like, I don't know what it'd be like to be a man in my position, and whether that would mean that we'd have had things easier, or maybe might not have been judged. But did a kind of a course the other day around kind of diversity and inclusion, and they talk quite a lot about like emotional labor. And I'm not saying that as someone that's white and middle class that I haven't had a lot of advantages in life, because I definitely have, but it made me think a little bit about like some of the things which you do as a woman that you're more, you kind of think about more. So you might be more conscious of what you look like when you're going into a big meeting and how you might get perceived. You won't necessarily spend hours working on, but it's a kind of a bit of a weight to, I guess, some of the kind of emotional weight that you have to carry as a woman. And I think that's certainly something which I don't think men have to worry about so much in terms of their perception. So if you're, I don't know, as an example, I remember going and pitching to, when we were doing our fundraise, to just loads and loads of men, essentially. And I think I met one woman along the way, and I think we pitched to about like 15 different private equity companies. And like, that's a bit, you know, you don't have the common threads that make it easy, the banter, the let's go for a beer instead. Like, it's difficult, I think, to do that as a female. in business when you're mainly operating in a male space, when it's particularly when you're talking about investment and things like that.
Do you think there's enough support or encouragement for female entrepreneurs and founders?
I think it's certainly picking up in press. I think there's much more support. So I know there are a lot of like kind of initiatives around supporting specifically female-led businesses. But I think the main thing that's sort of lacking is role models or visibility of them. And I think there are more and more women at the top in certain organizations, but predominantly still within, I think, the startup growth, you know, tech, you know, whatever it is that you're operating in. I think it's still largely dominated by men. And I think that is an unfortunate truth that means that you can't be what you can't see. And I think that is an important thing in terms of, you know, even if when it comes to mentoring, it's nothing wrong, obviously, having a male mentor and stuff. But sometimes it can help having a female that you can connect with. And it's a different sort of kind of relationship and will understand some of the nuances, which I just spoke about, around like perhaps the things that are difficult for being a female in business. So I think there are more, but I think you have to rely quite heavily on yourself to build those networks, to build that support network, to find people that you can relate to that help you think, what kind of leader do I want to be and what does that look like, because I'm not an alpha male, so I have to get comfortable in my own skin and things like that. So
do you ever suffer from imposter syndrome? Is it ever something that's popped up for you?
Oh my god, yeah, regularly. Especially because the product or like the industry I work in, I haven't had any experience in except for running this business. So I get this double imposter syndrome where I'm like, not only do I not always know what I'm doing because I'm kind of learning on the job, but also doubly to that, which is imposter syndrome in its very essence, I guess, is what that is. But then, yeah, doubled on that is like, yeah, I'm a female leader and I have, you know, you have to really work at that and feel like, and the funny, annoying thing about it is that I think the more confident you can be, the more of a leader you become. Like if you believe that you are a leader, you'll kind of naturally become it. It's the moment that you kind of doubt yourself, so you just have to like force those thoughts away and to your point, like get comfortable with the way that you do it and be authentic and real. And you know, if you're more like more, you know, emotional, then that's fine. Like I think you just need to own it, and it will excite people and energize people if you're really kind of like communicate in a way that's naturally you. If you start just to believe that you are a leader to some extent, you will become one.
Yeah, and I now just approach things just by thinking, how do I want to be treated in this situation? So like thinking about if the shoe was on the other foot and I'm dealing with this person or this problem, how would I want to be treated? If, and that's the way I try and separate. I have a real problem with work Katie and personal Katie, and I think as a leader and maybe as a female, that might be why, because I know that sometimes decisions I'm having to make decisions that's going to upset someone or cause problems, and that absolutely kills me. But I've got to separate work Katie that's doing the right thing for the company and personal Katie that, like, it's a really, but yeah, I think that's why I kind of try and think of myself as a leader in those situations. So I completely get that.
It's not saying that you have to like screw people over, but you have to kind of, like you said, like do things for what's best for the business. And that might mean that not everyone will be happy. And it's a really uncomfortable feeling, and not one that if you're a nice person that generally gets along with people, it doesn't necessarily come naturally.
Well, it's really hard. It's something that you've got to really fight against your natural instincts on, I think. But yeah, I'm completely with you there. If you had one tip for an aspiring female entrepreneur, what would that be?
My one tip would be, I think it's probably linked to kind of being yourself. I think there is a tendency, like I said earlier, to try and do things as a male counterpart would do, and I think it's really trying to focus in on who you are. So I think that for me, but also maybe this is a bit contradictory, one of the things I find really annoying when I speak to people, maybe women that start in businesses or running businesses, that sometimes that they can be a bit unambitious. And that's not because I think actually in their heads they want a really successful business that's, you know, I don't know, going to be the next unicorn or whatever. They're just sometimes scared to say it because it might sound arrogant or showing off a bit or whatever. And I really wish that people just particularly female business owners, were a bit more just like, yeah, I'm going to become the next unicorn company in the UK, and that's my goal, and that's absolutely fine. And I think not doubt yourself to like just say the big ambitious thing that you want to do and not be confident, which maybe goes against my like be yourself mantra. But I think it's partly because sometimes you have something in your mind and you say, oh, this is what I really want to do, but then you what comes out your mouth might sound a bit smaller and you might minimize it. So that probably be my tip, which is like, yeah, be bold.
Being yourself doesn't mean compromising your personality, but I think ambition is something that you should never apologize for, and I think that is it. I think that's an amazing thing to tell people, is like you can still be yourself and want to do the best without having to go in a room and start shouting and screaming because that's what you feel like you should be doing. How have you found this year personally? How's COVID lockdown 1 and 2.0 been for you? What have you enjoyed?
I guess seeing the business success, like it has been brilliant, and seeing how we've grown, and that's been really exhilarating. And yeah, weirdly, like it's a bit of a turning point for the business. I think it's definitely accelerated us further than we anticipated, certainly in the next couple of years. So that's been brilliant. I've liked how much I've grounded myself to some extent. Like you've become much more like comfortable just doing like small things. I also cook so much more than I did before this year. Like I've always loved cooking, like I said, but since running the business, it's totally dropped off. And now I find myself cracking open all my cookbooks again and eating really well. Sometimes I think I'm eating probably a bit too much, which might be a bit problematic. Downsides, I find, I guess a bit of a theme through what I've said today is like getting creative input really difficult, trying to be inspiring to a team when you're not necessarily feeling inspired, and the monotony. For somebody that starts up a business by the very nature of wanting to avoid a general normal job, being then stuck in your Zoom world where you just see a lot of PowerPoint presentations, that for me is like, I have to try. I've been actively trying to change that, even if that is sort of still the nature of what lockdown is. So I really, really miss that. So yeah, those are probably my highs and my lows of it.
The podcast is obviously called I Shouldn't Say This, but because in each episode I open up with what we were talking about really is that honesty, and I talk about subjects that someone as a role of an MD probably normally avoid. So I've talked about things like anxiety, imposter syndrome, fear of failure. Would you mind ending this podcast with an admission of something that you probably shouldn't say, whether that's struggles that you faced in your own career, a secret about your own lockdown experience, or what you'd like to change about the industry or yourself? So I'm going to say, Pippa Marie, I shouldn't say this, but over to you.
I shouldn't say this, but there are definitely days where I wish I didn't do what I did, which sounds bizarre because when I actually talk about my company and what I do, I absolutely love it. And generally there are days where, you know, I couldn't imagine doing anything else. I love it that much, but there are definitely, and particularly this year, have been days where, you know, I've really struggled to see, you know, why I'm doing this. Hence, I guess some of my like interruptions of ways to kind of keep me motivated. And I think it's something that I feel often quite guilty about, is that when I lose lack of direction or motivation, I always think I should be the most motivated person in the room. You know, it's my business. But I think it's okay. And I think it's sort of over time, certainly this year, kind of had to kind of recognize that like we're all human in this kind of, even if you're running a company, there are still days where you have wobbles where you think, oh, I just don't know why I'm doing this. This is just really, really hard. So I think it's a kindness that you need to play to yourself, and like honesty that, you know, sometimes it's really difficult, and running a business isn't always a startup in particular, just beers on a Thursday night. Like there are really tough moments which stretch you. So for me, it's sort of like, that's probably my admission, which sometimes I think, God, I wish I wasn't doing this. And yeah, it feels uncomfortable because it's my business. I should be the one most engaged.
I think that was a brilliant one. Thank you for being so honest. It's really hard to say that, but I completely can see where sometimes I'm like, why am I doing this? Why am I putting myself through it? But thank you so much. Thank you for being so open, so honest, and really, really insightful. And I really can't wait to see what happens with Pippa and Nut next. I wish you all the best.
Cheers. Thank you so much.